Take a network break. Grab a virtual donut and join us for our weekly scramble through today's tech news. Greg is still on vacation, but he couldn't stay away, so he's dialing in from an undisclosed location in the South Pacific. Greg, how are things?
Oh, it is very late on a Friday night, and people will never know how much I gave up to be here to bring you the network break.
You've come off the beach, come down from the mountains to weigh
That's
in.
That's it, yes. I should be neck deep in low-priced cocktails right about now. However, I am stone cold sober, and I have spent the day preparing, sifting my way through the dross that is the current IT market, trying to find little gems to be able to talk about in today's show. So hopefully we've got something that's interesting to everybody, I hope.
All right, let's find out. A couple of bits of news to take care of first. Today's virtual donuts are sponsored in part by Cumulus Networks. When customers want to build a private cloud environment that is open, modern, and simpler to manage, they choose Cumulus Linux. To learn more about open networking, head to cumulusnetworks.com/open. We're also sponsored by the WAN Summit. Networking professionals are gathering at the WAN Summit in New York City, March 9th and 10th. Find out how your peers are selecting and deploying SD-WAN. Enterprise registrants get a special rate of only $99 to attend, and Network Break listeners can get an extra 20% off if you use the code PACKETPUSHERS, that's all one word in all caps, when you register for the New York event. All the details are at wansummit.com. Last but not least, after the news, we talk with Riverbed about the critical role of visibility in network security and how Riverbed brings together packets, flows, and logs for a comprehensive InfoSec view. All right, let's get to the business. First, a follow-up from me. Last week, I talked about a new cloud service from TUFIN. It's called Secure Cloud. It essentially lets you run policy and security checks against your cloud services and how they're configured. I misspoke last week saying that the service doesn't yet integrate with CI/CD pipelines. In fact, you can integrate Secure Cloud with your developer tools and processes so that you can make policy and security checks part of your dev pipeline. So sorry about that, TUFIN. Make sure we got that corrected. And there's a link in the show notes if you want to find out more about that service.
Yeah, easy to make these mistakes, to be fair.
Yeah, I got a briefing. I misunderstood, misheard in that briefing. I looked at my notes and communicated to you incorrectly. So I appreciate TUFIN reaching out to correct us so that we can correct ourselves and make sure the right information is out there.
And a reminder to everybody listening that your follow-up and your feedback is welcome. If you go over to packetpushers.net/FU, you can, that's capital F, capital U, or just FU, you can leave us any commentary or feedback about any of the articles. And as we ran the show, a special show every month or two, once we build up enough feedback, we'll run a special show where we just tackle all the feedback and that you've got. We love hearing from what people are doing out there in the real world. We love hearing your points of view. We'll bring them together and then read them back to the audience so that we make sure that we cover everybody's perspective. It's not just about what we think. We're just offering our views and opinions. It's very important that we hear what you have to say. So do let us know what you're thinking.
Yes. And the FU is for follow-up, not the other thing.
So. That's right.
All right. Some news for you. Dell Technologies, they're selling off RSA to a consortium of buyers for just over $2 billion in an all-cash purchase. The sale includes RSA security businesses as well as the iconic RSA conference. If you will remember, way back in 2006, EMC acquired RSA for $2.1 billion. So Dell, which now owns EMC, is shedding it for about the same price.
Which is interesting because the original discussion that came on in the share market about a year ago was that they were touting it around in the market for about $1 billion. And the success of the security industry over the last 12 months, and especially things like the rise of ransomware, and we've seen a lot of high-profile companies go under, probably has doubled the price in the last year. So Dell's done pretty well out of this. The question is, why would they sell it? I think there's a few things here. One is Dell continues to have very high levels of debt, something like $30 billion worth of debt from when they took the business private. Although they continue to float off bits of the business, we've talked a lot on this show about the financials and how the IT infrastructure market is shrinking. And in Dell's case, their server and networking business revenues have dropped 16%. For the third consecutive quarter to $4.2 billion. So now it's got other money coming in, like desktops is up and all that sort of thing. They're not in a bad way at all, but some of the core infrastructure markets are shrinking quite substantially. We saw Cisco's recent financials go badly. A number of other companies have seen substantial declines, like 3 to 5% over the last. And the general trend is that these businesses are shrinking as enterprise IT stops buying or pauses the buying. And So Dell needs the cash. If I was a debt holder of Dell's debt, I'd be saying like, time to make sure I'm getting that cash back as quickly as possible. So I'd be leaning on Dell to say, you need to repay these loans as quickly as possible, or at least assure us that we don't need to call those debts in.
Yeah.
So interesting that it managed to sell it for twice what they originally were touting it around in the middle of last year. So they haven't been a fast buyer. And I think the point here is that the security market is just absolutely white hot, a growth of 10% or more. So finding buyers was not hard and a good price was reasonable. And also from Dell's point of view, they have SecureWorks. So they still have a whole security business unit, and RSA was a complete copy of the SecureWorks business unit. So I guess when you go and have a look at SecureWorks, I haven't looked at it too closely in recent years, and have another close look. It's very cloud. It's very software-centric, whereas RSA has looked very old and tired and, you know, back a heritage company, shall we say.
I didn't know that they were initially shopping it around for $1 billion, and the fact that they got $2 billion is great. But when you think about the fact that it was originally bought back in 2006 for about the same price, and that security is so hot that RSA hasn't managed to grow in that security market, not a great sign for where RSA is in terms of the offerings it's presenting. We should also remember that Dell also owns VMware, which is moving very, very hard into the security space. They've got firewalls, they've got load balancers, they've got web application firewalls, they've got IPS capabilities. So I think they felt like RSA is not necessarily bringing much to the table, and we need the cash.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's basically the sum of it. And, you know, this is the unpicking of the EMC Federation. There was a big thing about the, you know, back in the day, EMC and Cisco were both pursuing federated business models. That is, you have these business units which you, and HPE to some extent has also still following the same strategy, you know, like the Aruba networks are part of HPE, and HPE has quite a few business units like that. They're owned by HPE, but they're not actually HPE. They're branded. They still retain their main brand. And that's where you have this sort of federation model where you own them at least substantially or in total, but you don't actually acquire them. You let them run on their own so that your core business doesn't drag down these highly, you know, flexible and adaptive business units. And EMC was doing that as well. But keep in mind that EMC also had VirtuStream, which is a public cloud offering. You don't really hear much about that. Mm. Pivotal wasn't able to survive as a standalone business. We talked about that during the acquisition. The VCE, if you can remember the VMware, Cisco, and EMC alliance with the V-blocks.
These were converged infrastructures, right?
And the converged infrastructure is still there. So Dell obviously now has replaced the Cisco servers with the Dell servers, entirely predictably. But somehow these converged offerings are still different from the hyper-converged offerings, mainly for customers who believe that EMC. And I think the EMC storage is a very much a cash business. It's into rent extraction, you know, captive customers, limited innovation, very high margins, very high professional services, lots of high-pressure enterprise sales. Yeah. So if you want to read more about that, Chris Evans and his blog at Architecting IT did a good blog post on how the death of the EMC Federation, the slow, and had a lot of good takes on this if you want to read more about that logic.
All right, link for that in the show notes. Staying with RSA and the RSA conference in particular, two major sponsors, AT&T and IBM, have pulled out of the 2020 event in the United States, citing concerns for employee safety because of the coronavirus. So according to RSA, this is 13 companies to date that have pulled out, six from the U.S., six from China because of travel restrictions, and one Canadian.
Yeah, I think it's reasonable gamble that the RSA conference will struggle for attendees, and it'll probably get cancelled like Mobile World Congress was. I'm sure you talked about that last week, that conference was cancelled. And, you know, Mobile World Congress was a big deal. It's 100,000 attendees all coming to Barcelona to talk about 5G. I mean, everybody can't stop talking about 5G, so to cancel that conference is like thought leaders the world over are going like, but what am I going to think now? You know, it's kind of difficult. It's interesting here that the question here is, why are companies pulling out? And obviously the Chinese companies are pulling out for obvious reasons. Partly it's to do with travel restrictions, like they're not able to freight people out.
Right.
And also they wouldn't be very popular even if they did turn up. No matter what they said, you know, we've, you know, hand tested every single one of these people that's there. People aren't going to believe it. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. So it makes sense for them to pull out. And then I started to think, why are the US companies pulling out? And the answer finally struck me is I think it's because most US tech companies actually self-insure their health insurance off their balance sheet. So they don't actually have back-end insurance. They actually just pay for the health, the employee health insurance plan. They allocate so much money to it, and it just pays out of the current balance sheet. And so if they start shipping employees off to these conferences and they come back with coronavirus, that actually comes out of the balance sheet, and that's a pretty substantial risk to the company. So it's actually like a CFO decision, especially for US companies where the health insurance is very high. You know, when if you have to pay for that out of your balance sheet, and then you also have to pay, you know, your employees and all that sort of stuff. So I think it'd be interesting to sort of that's the angle. That's why the US companies want to pull out of this.
There may be something to that. My take is probably it's more sort of legal butt covering. They don't want to take the risk of someone getting sick and then them getting sued or looking bad because of it. So it seems more like a lawyer came up and said, hey, maybe it's not a great idea to send folks to San Francisco during this outbreak. I also wonder, IBM, it's a major sponsor of the RSA conference, but not a huge presence in the security market per se. So maybe they also feel like, yeah, this is one we can skip. I also wonder if they'll take this opportunity to look at going forward, do we need to be at shows like this?
It's going to be interesting to see the impact here. Like Facebook's canceled its conference in San Francisco, the Mobile World Congress. If many more conferences get totally wound up, and a lot of them are actually just being canceled outright, as we see, and we're seeing more, I suspect there'll be blanket bans if the coronavirus thing or the COVID-19, however you want to talk about it, continues to go on. I suspect all conferences will come to a halt. And we've talked plenty of times on this show, and I've expressed my opinion that I think conferences are overrated. Now, they're certainly good fun. There's certainly value in face-to-face conversation. But is it really necessary to send your staff to 20 conferences a year to get face-to-face with customers and potentially see the same customers over and over and over?
Right.
Or could we start using, like, the internet to be work smarter instead of, you know, spend days in transit to and from a conference? You know, the sort of time poverty that it causes me. Like, I will be at the Aruba Atmosphere conference in Las Vegas on the 22nd of March, 22nd to the 24th of March, for example.
Yeah, you and I will both be there.
We'll both be there, right? Now, you know, that's going to be 4 days on the ground. It's going to be 2 days either side. I'm going to lose a week, including jet lag, to attend an event. That sort of creates a massive amount of poverty, time poverty, where I have to cover all of that. And that's the challenge here. Do we really need to be doing conferences? So it'll be interesting to see if conferences, I think, survive not going. If the sales happen without the conferences, the question will be, should we be at conferences?
And that could be... If I was IBM, I would take this opportunity to measure sort of how are our sales numbers, how are our lead numbers, how are our new business initiative numbers with and without RSA, do a little A-B testing and really think about what is the value here. Not to say that, you know, conferences are bad and people shouldn't go, but you've got limited amount of money, you've got a limited amount of time. Sending people to these things is expensive, both in regular cost and, as you mentioned, time cost. And now it could potentially get folks sick. So you got to really think hard about where you need to be and why.
It's interesting. I've had a couple of invitations from companies to attend virtual events. So after MWC was cancelled, Huawei in particular reached out and said, we're going to hold a virtual event. And they had a bunch of announcements. We'll cover them later down in the show that would have come out in MWC. And I would never have known about. But now I can cover them because I can see them.
Right.
They would have just been buried under the piles of waffle that would have come from all, you know, Ericsson and Nokia and Cisco and, you know, whoever.
The deluge of press releases, yes.
Yeah, you know, and would not have seen these. And now there was a virtual event held yesterday and I can troll my way through them all in an RSS feed. It's quite good.
Yeah, I guess we could also do a bet for you and I. Will we actually be in Las Vegas for Aruba or will that get the axe as well? We've got about a month out, so...
Interesting. It's a smaller conference. I think smaller conferences is a different game. I think the larger conferences is, you know, it's a much higher exposure. We'll see.
Absolutely.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. Moving on. We're recording this episode the Friday before the RSA conference, so there are lots of vendors have lined up product announcements around the show. One of those is ExtraHop. They are adding IoT device discovery and behavior profiling to their RevealX product. RevealX gets traffic feeds off the network to do detailed packet analysis of headers and payloads. It then can use this information to fingerprint IoT devices. So what is the role control, what is the manufacturer, what is the OS, and also see who the device communicates with. The idea is that they can look for regular behavior and anomalous behavior. You know, for instance, if a security camera starts talking to an outside server that it shouldn't. Mm-hmm.
So ExtraHop has made a lot of investments into machine learning, and this is an extension of what that is. So the machine learning is looking for patterns in the data flows between devices, and ExtraHop obviously feels that their machine learning capability, which they've been developing for quite a number of years now, has reached the point where they can productize it, specifically targeting IoT use cases. And I like it. I like this idea a lot. Remember, ExtraHop sits in the network. The packets flow across the box. It can assume flow records and a number of other data points so that it can get a bigger picture of the network, like most other of these visibility products, security visibility products. And I think ExtraHop's got real credibility here in the terms of they've always been compute-centric or software-centric in their approach. They've always used hardware to gather data at high speed, and their devices have been high-performance devices, but they haven't been a hardware-centric company. They've been had to be hardware to get powerful enough to put the data and store the data, but now they're much more moving into the software. So I think this is an interesting product and one that people should be looking at if you're connecting a lot of IoT into your network and you want to be able to start to see what the IoT is doing. This might be one product to put into your, you know, top three list.
Yeah, I think IoT is very much hot in the security area now because of the potential vulnerabilities they expose you to and the fact that for most IoT devices, you can't put any kind of endpoint agent on it to do that endpoint control. So you do need some kind of other mechanism to keep an eye on them, who they're connecting to, what they're talking to, and their behavior. VMware picked up Nyansa recently. They have similar capabilities in terms of IoT device identification and behavior monitoring. So,
Yeah, lots of companies fingerprinting. They can fingerprint an IoT device, and they can see it because they capture the data. And it's all based around deep learning and machine learning.
Yeah, so I agree it's a logical extension of what ExtraHop's already doing, and you get to slap IoT in your marketing.
And it is a thing. Like if you're a hospital with cameras and medical devices...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that those are not compromised. Absolutely. That's real. All right. A little quick news about one of our sponsors today, Cumulus Networks. You may have heard the term white box and open networking being used interchangeably. Cumulus Networks wants you to know they're not the same thing. Open networking is hardware. That's the actual white box plus software. So open networking is white box plus best-in-class automation across the network with native integrations with automation tools like Ansible and Salt. Operational efficiency because it's pure and native Linux, so it gives you the ability to manage your data center switches the same way you manage servers. You get a choice of what hardware you use and greater control over the operation of your software and your network OS. Open networking is built for scale at inception due to architectural scalability for L2 and L3. So basically, open networking is a full and innovative solution that gives you everything you'd get from legacy networking all on a white box. So stop confusing open networking with the white box. It's so much more. Companies are coming to Cumulus Networks when they want to build a private cloud environment that's open, modern, and simpler to manage. They've got two core products, Cumulus Linux, it's their Linux open networking OS, and NetQ, which gives you end-to-end actionable insight from the host of the switch. If you want to learn more about open networking and Cumulus, head to cumulusnetworks.com/open. It's cumulusnetworks.com/open. And we thank them for being a sponsor. All right, back to the news. The startup Nubeva, we had talked about them a little bit in the past. They initially came to market with a packet broker for public clouds, are refocusing on Nubeva TLS Decrypt. This is an out-of-band decryption solution that can capture the ephemeral session encryption keys that are used in TLS 1.3 encrypted traffic, which allows you to then decrypt individual sessions and then send those to your favorite device for analysis.
So I wasn't there, and this is a briefing that you took, and I wasn't able to attend.
There. You were on vacation. Now,
what we've seen with other vendors, like ExtraHop, for example, is that they actually use an agent on the endpoints to extract the key,
That's what they can do here.
Yeah. So that makes sense. I think ultimately, if you're going to install the agent and then do the interception because you need to do it for your purposes, and remember, there are purposes when interception of the end-to-end flow is needed, then this is the way. This is really the only way you're going to do it at the moment.
Yeah, and just to be clear, they wanted to make sure that this is positioned. It's not a man in the middle. It's an out of band. So you do have what they call a sensor. It's essentially an agent that runs on the host. It's looking in memory for that ephemeral key. It captures the key, sends this key to what is essentially a database. And then your packet broker, whether it's Nubeva or another, captures the encrypted traffic, sends it over to this database, which matches it up with the right key, and then there's a third system that actually does the decryption, and then you can send it off to your favorite analysis tools. So it's an out-of-band decryption scheme.
Yes. So this idea of cracking TLS, it's not man in the middling it without transparently, without any awareness of the user. There actually has to be a manual step where you've installed an agent on the servers to get a hold of the per session key. It's not, and it's, yeah.
Yeah, because one of the things about TLS 1.3 that's causing folks a lot of issues is that it's harder to do man in the middle because of those ephemeral keys that are used to encrypt each individual session, as opposed to having a single private key that's encrypting everything. It's harder to do man in the middle with a TLS 1.3, which was the whole point of it.
Mm-hmm. And this is why service meshes are struggling a little bit, because TLS 1.3 makes their life a little bit difficult, but they actually do terminate and then reinitiate. So they are full inline proxies. But again, because they are configured as part of the service, the same thing happens. So these types of things always happen. The question is, how do you scale it up to be useful? And the Nubeva approach gives you visibility without having to enable a service mesh to get the packet captures or to get into the data stream.
Yeah. And this TLS decrypt from Nubeva works in cloud services, it works in containers, it works in Kubernetes, and they also have an on-prem version for your data centers. So we've got links in the show notes if you want to check it out. Moving on, Spirent, you know them for the network and security testing products they make. They've added endpoint capabilities to their CyberFlood data breach assessment product. You can now put agents on Windows 10 devices and Windows Server 2016 servers to incorporate them into data breach assessment. If you're not familiar with the data breach assessment, it's essentially a library of known attacks, and you run these against your security infrastructure, your firewalls, your IDSs, and now endpoints to see what your security tools are catching and what they're missing.
Yeah, the Spirent role here is quite unique. Their approach to this is to say, here's a bunch of known tests, and we can throw that, generate them at very high volume and see what happens to your nodes. And this flood assessment or data breach assessment is actually meant to stress test your infrastructure with a bunch of known attacks. And to sort of simulate the real world of the internet. And for those people who have really critical resources and have the time to run these tests, Spirent has an interesting solution. So this CyberFlood puts a device in your network, and then you say, you know, run me 100,000 sessions of this attack, you know, or run me a suite of attacks. Use the top 300 known attacks, run them at 10 gigabits per second against my server farm, and let's see if anything gets through and if it dies. Is there a breach? Does it die? It's kind of a cross between load generation and security breaching as a load generation tool. So really interesting product. I saw a demo of it during a field day event earlier in the year. And for people who need it, it's definitely something that you want to have.
Yeah, they can also mix the traffic to be sort of, they mimic regular traffic and then throw in some attacks in there just to see if your firewall or IPS is actually catching it as it passes through. So yeah, an interesting, and it's for the enterprise, not just, you know, big testing company. So if this sounds appealing to you, again, links in the show notes.
Yeah, I can't make up my mind if it's a blue team or a red team. Like if, you know, red team is trying to penetrate and blue team's trying to handle the defense. It's actually could be both. You could, you know, the blue team, it could use it to sort of stress test their infrastructure and, as you say, generate 10 gigabits per second of traffic and then drift in 500 megabits per second of known, you know, well-known attacks and see what happens. And red team is could use it as a flood attack, you know.
So yeah, my impression in talking to them is that they're positioning this more as a blue team kind of regular ongoing assessments. You run it not just once a year, but, you know, on a regular basis and as new attacks come out to make sure your security posture is up to date and ready to handle it. And they also do reporting. They'll tie into your SIEM to see what's getting logged. They'll tie into your ITSM to see if a ticket gets kicked off, if an attack makes it through, and then what happens there. So it is a whole general auditing, I think, tool for your security posture.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
All right, moving on. Huawei, they've announced the global availability of their high campus product line. It includes 5G-powered wireless APs, optical networking for the campus, and AI-powered management.
Yeah, so this was some announcements that I picked up on, and campus networking really fascinates me because it's that back-to-the-campus theme we've seen from the networking vendors. They've been off playing with multi-cloud and hybrid cloud and data centers, and they've suddenly realized that there's not actually that much money there, and the return to Wi-Fi and the wired campus has been rather dramatic and visible, and you and I have taken every opportunity to sort of poke some gentle fun at that, but seeing Huawei announce its campus strategy is quite interesting in the sense that they're talking about 10 new Wi-Fi 6 capable access points in their Air Engine series. And they have their own recent set of announcements around the Air Engine, around new silicon and new models and new software and so forth. And their campus solution actually uses a SDN management tool called eSight, which they call AI-powered unified management platform to centrally operate and maintain various devices in the campus and automatically optimize wireless radio frequencies, blah, 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 blah. Now, there's a certain amount of bloviation and marketing excitement going on there, over-excitement. And so I'd take it with a dose of salt. But I do think that Huawei has got a full spectrum portfolio here in the campus, and it may not be suitable for purchasing in the US, but it may be in Europe if that's your inclination. But we also have an audience in Africa and the Asia Pacific who may be interested in acquiring Huawei products, and they do have a full spectrum of campus, you know, a campus strategy going on right across the product range, as well as their data center. The optical networking for the campus, I don't know about you, but I didn't think that was DWDM. I think it was just fiber optic interfaces on the switches.
As you said, the release is information light, so hard to tell.
Yeah, decoding it was a bit difficult. But I thought I'd mention it because I think it's very interesting. If you want to have a look at it, one of the things I noticed as part of the press release is that Huawei is making a big deal about being recognized in January 2020 as a Gartner Peer Insight Customer Choice. Now, Gartner Peer Insights is when customers go onto Gartner's website, mm-hmm. the Peer Insights, and say which is their favorite customer, you know, which is their favorite vendor, and which is their favorite product. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the line in 2020, Huawei was recognized for their wired and wireless campus stuff, highly popular and managed to rank in terms of customers. So you could draw some conclusions. You could go off and read the press release and see what your personal preference is as to whether the, you know, they got a lot of customers to talk about it. Maybe they got some encouraged customers to go and talk to Gartner. A lot of these things can be driven. Mm-hmm. But I would also point out that there's a lot of products. You know, Huawei has a substantial market penetration in certain parts of the world, and it may just be that those customers are willing to get involved and say, you know, tell Gartner that Huawei's just as good as anybody else.
Yep. Everybody loves Gartner.
Yeah, apparently.
Never hurts. All right, moving on. Apple is pushing back against long-term certificates in their Safari browser. And Greg, you picked this story up.
Yeah, lots to unpack here. Basically, the short story is Apple is announcing that they're going to block anybody who's dropping TLS certificates that have got more than 13 months of life. And this is something that we've seen progressively going on. I think you seem to remember, Drew, about 2 years ago, maybe a year ago, we talked about this when Google wanted to reduce the TLS certificate validity periods to 1 year.
Right.
And it was eventually thrown out. I think it was about a year ago.
I do remember talking about that. Yeah, probably last year. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it looks like Apple's decided to get a little bit more, yeah, we're just going to do it in the browser. So couldn't do it a year ago, maybe we can do it a year later. Okay, I'm sort of on board with this, and I think this is what I said back then, is that on balance, this is a good thing for the internet. And the long story is the certificate authorities that issued TLS certificates didn't want to maintain the infrastructure so that when people revoked certificates, so if you create a certificate with a 5 or a 10-year lifespan, if you ever want to revoke that certificate, you can't in practice. In theory, there should have been certificate revocation lists, but the certificate authorities who issued the certificates refused to build out CRL infrastructure that operated at speed, and the protocols needed to have some work, and nobody wanted to work on them. Mm-hmm. And the CAs just said, bugger that, we'll just take the easy profits. And if someone's foolish enough to run a 10-year, pay us for a 10-year TLS certificate, we'll sell it to them. It's free money for us.
Yep.
So really the only way to practically revoke certificates is to have short lifetimes. So for example, Let's Encrypt only gives you a 3-month default long certificate. And effectively, you know, if you have a breach and somebody steals your cert, you've got a maximum of 3 months before the certificate has to be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
So this bringing it down to 12 months, I think eventually you're going to see over some period of years a trend from the people in the internet community to bring it down to 3 months so that we don't have to use certificate revocation lists, because none of the browsers look up the list by default anymore anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So this forces people who are using long-term certificates to change their practices. They're going to have to automate their certificate issuance. So just like Let's Encrypt gives you all the tools in the world to automate you know, going back, getting a new certificate, going back, getting a new certificate every month or 2 months is automated. And too bad for the people who don't. Suck it up.
Yes, I agree entirely. Got nothing else.
It's not elegant and it's not pretty, but I think it's probably the only practical way forward. People just don't want to do this for themselves. They can't help themselves, but do it the wrong way. And so we end up with this situation.
Yeah. And it's interesting that Apple is leading with this. Part of their brand now is about being privacy friendly. So this aligns with that brand. I don't know that Safari has the browser market clout to really force the whole industry to change, but if they start, others may follow. So we'll see what happens.
I think so. And ultimately, Apple tends to act in the best interests of the consumer. They're no angels. They're not perfect. I'm not saying that. But generally, they do have much more of a genuine focus on the end user or the consumer and acting in a way which is generally beneficial for people.
On balance, when you line them up with all the other big Silicon Valley companies, they are the least worst. I agree.
Yes.
When it comes to the consumer, yes.
I'll go with least worst. Yep.
what an appellation. Congratulations. You're the least worst. All right. A quick word to tell you about our other sponsor today, the WAN Summit. Networking professionals are gathering at the WAN Summit in New York City, March 9th and 10th at the WAN Summit. They are going to share their unique WAN experiences. You can understand and appreciate how your peers are tackling the same challenges, like selecting and deploying SD-WAN, maximizing bandwidth while minimizing costs, getting security in there. There are also WAN Summits happening around the world. If you can't make New York, you can see a full list at WANsummit.com. And don't forget, March 9th and 10th at the Hilton Midtown in New York City, the WAN Summit New York. It's their 7th year in New York, and they're expecting almost 400 WAN professionals. You can register for only $99. And if you use the special network break code of Packet Pushers, all one word, Packet Pushers, you get an extra 20% off that $99. Get all the details at WANsummit.com. That's WANsummit.com, and we hope to see you there.
Big fan of small conferences like that. 400 people, that's just the right size for me.
It is, and if you're really looking for that peer-to-peer interaction, which to me tends to be the most valuable parts of an event, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's good stuff. All right, back to the news. Arista, they announced their Q4 and full year 2019 fiscal results recently. For the fourth quarter, they had revenues of $552.5 million, which was down 16% year over year, but a net income of $260 million. For the full year, the company posted $2.4 billion in revenue, which is up 12% year over year, and a net income just shy of $860 million.
Yeah, so this is basically related to the fact that the cloud companies have slowed down their purchasing.
Yes.
I would think that some part of this is related to coronavirus and the predicted slowdown in purchasing and manufacturing as well. We're seeing, I was reading some tweets today from some IDC analysts, and they're predicting that the slowdown could have as much as a 10% impact because there's just not going to be any products manufactured. They believe that most factories are running at about 30% of capacity, and they have enough parts to take them through till the mid-March sort of time frame. Okay. And after that, stock shortages will start to prevent production lines from keeping going. And if China doesn't restart, then it could take months before we see production lines ramping up to maximum capacity. So you may actually see straight up stock shortages. There's just nothing that you can buy in the market because there's no components to be made. Now, a lot of companies are shifting their manufacturing away from China to sort of, you know, starting to build up their purchasing pipelines on Japan or Taiwan or Korea or whatever. But that's a long-term move. We've talked about that already. A lot of the U.S. trade stuff may have actually helped a bit here. You know, we talked about the trade wars a little bit.
Yes.
But this is going to be interesting. I think Arista is showing its weakness to the cloud giants and how they're scaling back as customers are slowing their adoption into the public cloud. And then people are finding the public cloud harder and harder, realizing how costly it is to be there, like far more costly than doing it on-premise overall. And also costly in terms of, you know, the internal professional services cost.
Yeah.
But also because they're not getting into the campus as quickly as they might have wished. They've certainly hit the goals that they've given to investors, but they tend to have a history of saying to investors, yeah, we'll be able to jump over that, you know, 3-foot bar, 3-inch bar on the, you know, and then come out with big numbers. So I think, you know, they really need to work hard to convince enterprises that they've got a campus strategy.
Well, and that may play into part of the Big Switch acquisition. And we talked about this last week. Arista officially finally announced, yes, they are the ones who did buy Big Switch. It has happened. It was an undisclosed amount. And it seems like the major draw for Arista in this purchase was the big monitoring fabric from Big Switch, which lets you essentially do packet brokering for much less money than a typical packet broker company. So, and that's very much a campus or data center play.
Yeah, I saw the Big Switch acquisition as being two things. One is the big monitoring fabric, which is a new revenue stream for Arista, and it also puts them into the security market. So if Arista decides to start being a firewall company or a security company, it's got better credibility based around the fact that it has this visibility fabric.
Absolutely.
So that was obviously the short-term cash flow, but I don't want to underestimate Big Switch's multi-cloud product, where they were actually able to say, well, if their big push over the last 12 months has been around their VPC product, and they were saying, well, if you're going to be in the public cloud, and they've got this virtual private cloud model, this virtual private networking model, where you just get this group of sub, you know, all of those hosts are in this group and all those hosts, and you want to tag them and connect them and all that. Well, then Big Switch has said, well, why don't you just bring that to your own data center as well? So have the same networking strategy in AWS or Google Cloud as you do on-prem. And I think that's a real turnaround for Arista, because that finally gives them a multi-cloud strategy which can stick. You know, the old idea of putting EOS in router instances in the cloud is kind of like very 2015.
Yeah.
And always felt a bit out of touch. It met the needs of some customers, but I suspect a lot of customers were saying, we need more than that. And so I think Arista gets a multi-cloud strategy and the start of a security story.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what they do with the Big Cloud Fabric, because it would mean Switch Lite, that the Big Switch network OS has to run somewhere. Will that be on Arista switches? Will it be on third-party switches? And what does that mean for EOS and for Cloud Vision? They'll have to do some integration work there, because part of Arista's core value proposition was one OS everywhere, easier to manage, easier to operate. And so that starts to erode a little bit if you're starting to throw Switch Lite in.
Mm. And I think it comes at a good time for them. They've obviously lost momentum with the public clouds. A lot of their revenue came from the, you know, selling switches to AWS and Microsoft in particular.
Yeah.
And if that money starts to turn away as Microsoft slows down, as it starts to digest the sort of, you know, data centers that it's already built, that means that they really, really have to look at getting back into the enterprise and, you know, taking on that campus thing. So, you know, yep. I don't think it's going to hurt them too badly. Arista's been – it's hard to bet against Arista. They've been so good on execution, you know, and building a business in the face of full-on competition from Cisco. They've
Absolutely.
Really yeah. proven that they can make that happen. But, you know, they're going to be all over the enterprise very, very strongly in the years ahead. They have to, because I think the cloud – they're losing traction in the cloud generally.
Yeah. Arista was at Tech Field Day recently, so there's a couple of links in the show notes. If they're talking specifically about Big Monitoring Fabric in one of the videos, and there's also a Q&A with some executives afterward about Big Switch acquisition, so you can check that out if you'd like.
Big Switch customer, don't be disheartened. It's very clear that Arista wants you.
Yes, I think that's the case. I'm curious to watch this and see how it evolves over time. Hopefully it's a good home for Big Switch. All right, moving on. Cradlepoint, they've announced a 5G portfolio for the wireless edge. And Greg, this tickled your fancy a little bit.
Yeah, I like the story that Cradlepoint was making here. And, you know, I like to make a bit of fun of 5G as a general principle, because at this particular point, it's like a universal cornucopia of delights for thought leaders everywhere to just make up whatever it is that they want. But the version of 5G that Cradlepoint is pitching here is that, look, 5G is in flux. Every country's got a different approach and got to have flexibility here. You know, like 5G, for example, runs in the sort of 600 to 700 megahertz. There's another one at the 1.2 to 5 gigahertz range, and there's a range of 5G they're talking about doing at 6 gigahertz and above. And Cradlepoint point here is that you need a solution that's going to be able to weather wherever 5G goes, and they believe that they've got something for you to look at. So I thought this was interesting that they're announcing a refreshed hardware set and saying we're ready for 5G in whatever form it comes in. I think and it's hard to judge the truth of that, because some of the hardware details around 5G are pretty arcane. If you read the 3GPP specifications or the GSMA specifications, you'll tend to reach comatose levels of indifference fairly quickly, because, boy, it's boring. But there's something here. I think Cradlepoint, with their 5G and their particular products here, and we'll talk more about OpenGear in a minute, because that's the competitor that I see here.
Okay. Yeah, speaking of at the close of 2019, Digi International announced that it was acquiring Open Gear. They make out-of-band management equipment and other equipment. And we didn't talk about this when it went through, but we wanted to pick it up here.
Yeah, I think we missed it. The end of the year was a bit weird. We had a hell of a lot going on, and we might have missed this one. But Open Gear has been an independent source of very specific devices and very popular with people who use them for serial consoles for out-of-band management. They announced a new platform, Light Management or Light something. I can't quite remember what it's called, but they had an SDN product that came to market, which was well-received by a lot of people and allowed people to manage hundreds of these serial consoles effectively. And they were doing pretty well, and I don't really understand what they would sell for unless they just got an offer that they couldn't refuse. But I think what you're also seeing here is that these devices that connect to serial consoles allow you to activate legacy IoT devices or heritage IoT devices in your network, and you can now start to use those serial devices to sort of SDN them, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And this sort of Digi has been a really big buyer of serial console products for a long period of time. And if you remember back to modems in the days and all that sort of stuff. So good luck to Open Gear. I hope that they survive inside of the Digi family. They have a long history of buying up competitors and then generally munging them into a product family over time. But Digi has been around for a very long period of time, focused on the same market. So, yeah, I think it's a reaction to the success of companies like Cradlepoint. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have an interesting day, you could sit there and compare the Digi and Open Gear and the Cradlepoint and see what the difference is between these and which one and the feature differences between them and the tactical differences between these organizations to understand where the out-of-band market is going to be in, say, 3 to 5 years' time.
Okay. All right, a couple more stories before we wrap. One, Craig, I guess this is sort of a personal peccadillo for you regarding Juniper and its blogging, you know, which for us as consumers of network news, we like it when we can actually see and read the stuff and find it.
I think a few times on the podcast over the last 2 years, I've pointed out that we don't cover a lot of Juniper news because we can't access it. It's just they publish these blog posts and press releases in some arcane forum software that looks like it comes from 2005 or something, and it was almost unreadable. And I'm pleased to announce that Juniper sent me a press release yesterday saying that today, as we record, they're launching blogs.juniper.net. in a form on WordPress, no less.
Hey.
So, hey. And I've added it to my RSS reader, and I will now be seeing Juniper's blog posts and its press releases. This is very exciting stuff to see this sort of.
A little inside baseball, but yes.
Yeah, well, the problem here is that we have hundreds of sources of information. My RSS reader hits 500 websites to try and ingest it to put content together for the show. Yes. And I just couldn't put Juniper in there. I couldn't see Juniper in that feed because it didn't support RSS. So, oh well. I expect to be seeing more Juniper content being talked about on Packet Pushers and in the newsletter, in the HIM newsletter. We'll link to their stuff that they're publishing and we'll talk more about it because I'm going to be able to see it. So thanks, Juniper, for listening, I guess, is the good news.
Visibility counts.
Well, not quite. The visibility does count, but they use gray text. They're using text which is using which is 868666, which is actually this pale gray color on a white background, and it's a really thin font.
Oh,
it's kind of hard to read. So just one small criticism. Doing gray-colored fonts, I know Juniper's got a corporate standard around gray text or something, but it's so hard to read. Just make it black, right? 00000, yes. Black on white.
100%.
Make it so that, yeah. 100%. It's a really tight, anyway, whatever. I'm not going to, once it's in the RSS reader, I'm never going to see it in the original format anyway. So, you know, it's going to go through a parser where it just presents me the raw text, but that doesn't matter.
In any case, if you personally are thinking about rolling out a blog, black text on a white background, save everybody else the hassle of whatever other crazy scheme you might have been thinking.
If you do a blog, just make sure that the words are black on a white background.
Yes. Or,
and not the other way, and not white on a black background either. That doesn't
That's awful too, yes.
Yeah. for most people. For some people, it's not. I generally have an override on all the websites that does do white text on a black background, but then that's my privilege. That is.
Yeah. All right. Our final story is another intersection between tech and politics. Google and Oracle are locked in a court battle in which Oracle wants to collect around $8 billion in royalties from Google. They've accused Google of violating Oracle copyrights on Java code used in the Android mobile OS. Google has appealed the case all the way to the Supreme Court, and now the Trump administration has weighed in to urge the Supreme Court to reject Google's appeal. Larry Ellison is a Trump supporter and fundraiser, so that's where we're tying in the politics and tech.
Yeah, politics and tech continues to collide. In this case, it's highly visible, and it's also highly unusual for politics to engage in the legal process. It's not normal for the politicians to sit there and tell the courts, we're a friend of this person's court case. And what's also interesting is that President Trump announced his support for Oracle in the court case on the very same day that Larry Ellison, the CEO, founder, and billionaire from building Oracle, was hosting a substantial fundraiser for Trump. Apparently, it's $100,000 a couple to attend, and $200,000 a couple to attend the policy discussion sessions. So that's big money. You know, and for some people, if you get told that information, this perception might be polarizing to you. My point would be is that the optics of a senior politician supporting a corporate legal situation, apparently in direct relation to fundraising, is highly unusual. And while I don't want to get into the politics of the situation, I don't want to express an opinion. Certainly, I'm not letting my personal politics in here. I do think it's a positive that politics is engaging with technology, but I'm not sure that this sort of engagement is a positive, because it just feels so, you know, like billionaires buying off billionaires sort of thing.
So one thing, I think it is actually common for the government to weigh in on court cases. I think they call it amicus briefs, where third parties who aren't in the case can say, hey, here's our take on it. Here's who we support in this case. But it's usually because that party has some kind of interest or outcome in the stake. This is about one company trying to get royalties from another company. I don't know what the United States government, why they would have a dog in this fight. So, and the fact that there is this connection between Larry Ellison and the president, it smacks of a little bit of just blatant interference as opposed to a legitimate interest of the U.S. government.
This is all about Java, because Android is written in Java, and Oracle's saying that because of an API thing, Google can't run Java. It's a really end run around taking something out of Google's business. Now, the question here is, why is Oracle doing this? And I think in part because its heritage IT business is shrinking quickly. I think a lot of customers are a bit weary of Oracle, and there's some sort of squeeze here. And Larry Ellison has done a very good job of sort of, you know, going over people's heads. He's famous for his organization. If he can't win down in the IT team, he'll go straight to the CFO or the CEO and squeeze the deal out that way. It also has to be said that it seems that Oracle feels that this is something that they really must win to survive. They seem to be fighting this very, very hard indeed. And does it give them some sort of credibility to have the rights to Java that Google can't use? I'm not sure. Or perhaps Larry Ellison is 75 years old and just doesn't care anymore. That's another one, you know. Like he is an old white guy, billionaire, and 75 years old, and, you know, he's pulling what I would call to be a Joe Tucci. He wants to have his legacy. He wants to go out being known for something, not go out with his company being a failure. Maybe it's just straight up ego. I don't know. I'd be interested to hear what other people think.
Yeah, interesting. And just also a quick note on the other intersection of tech and politics. AWS is appealing the award of the JEDI defense contract to Microsoft, also citing political interference by the Trump administration because of personal animosity between the president and Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. So this is happening in lots of different places. Hmm.
And again, just to cover this off, I think I could wish to ignore politics in technology, but strategically, it's come to the point where IT architects or IT strategies need to consider these angles, because it affects your supply chains. If these types of arrangements go off and things don't go the way that you think they'll go, it could actually impact your purchasing policy. But it is good to see politicians engage with technology companies. Strange things happen when politicians get involved. Things take on weird directions or weird shifts. You know, we've covered these substantially, and we try to keep this minimalized. So, but it's also worth keeping in mind that, you know, oil, gas, and as a vertical market, or healthcare, are examples of markets that have extensive government and political engagement. And it's coming to me that maybe the future of IT is that we're moving down the same path where government and politics are intimately entwined with the technology futures that we take on.
Yeah, I don't think you can separate the two. And I think we are going to have to talk about politics and technology regularly. We'll do our best to keep our own political biases out of the conversation. But these two are now inextricably linked, and they can't be separated.
Yep. Yeah, we'll try and just say, you know, this is highly unusual for the executive to get involved in legal cases like this against a background of other things going on. So, you know, draw your own conclusions, I guess.
Absolutely. All right, well, that wraps up our news. Please stay tuned for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Riverbed on the integration of security and visibility. That's coming right up. Welcome to Tech Bytes, a podcast that explores essential products and technologies in about 15 minutes. Our topic today is the essential role that visibility plays in network security. Riverbed is our sponsor, and our guests are Marco Di Benedetto. He is SVP and CTO, and Vincent Burke, VP and Chief Architect for Security at Riverbed. Marco and Vincent, welcome to the podcast. So when thinking about visibility in regards to security, are you talking about alerts and alarms or something broader, more comprehensive?
Alerts and alarms give you only a very narrow view of any situation. And for us, visibility is a lot more than that. It's like comparing watching a movie to reading the transcript of a movie. And by the way, I'm talking about the transcript, not the book, right? reading a book is much better, but the transcripts are very dry. They don't have a lot of information. When you think about security, the way that it's understood in networking is typically firewall, IDS devices. And in the physical world, you would take your firewall, compare it to a gate, to locks, your identity system, whatever, and your IDS is a bunch of sensors. And the most archaic sensor would be a dog that is barking when somebody comes in and is trying to enter the premises.
I call this the alert theory. There's not enough alerts in the world, so we have to generate as many alerts as possible.
Yeah, and you can generate alerts, and sometimes they're useful, right? The dog will bark in times when there is something that is happening, but very often it will bark and nothing is really happening. And sometimes the mailman is going to...
Sometimes there's a squirrel up that tree, and sometimes there's an intruder coming on the premises. So in terms of a Riverbed solution, how do I go about deploying sufficient visibility to be of use? What's the differentiator here with Riverbed and your approach to security in the network?
Yeah, the goal here is to have the equivalent of security cameras within the environment, being able to record the network and be able to see everything that is happening while it's happening, but also after it happened.
So I think what you're saying to me there is that because there are many points in a modern network where you can actually capture data. Now, in years gone by, it wasn't possible to capture data in many places. And things have changed in networking. We've got bandwidth, we've got processing power. So one of the principles of Riverbed Security is this idea that you can collect anywhere.
Yeah, and that's we feel that is a very important aspect of security, right? You need to be able to collect things because you want to learn from what is happening to you. For us, this aspect of visibility might not be as important for threats that are already known, but it's a lot more important for zero-day type threats, where there's no technology out there that can automate what you're trying to see, and so seeing it for yourself is going to be critical. And when somebody is asking you for forensic evidence, you need to have the data stored somewhere that are going to be allowing you to figure out what happened. Otherwise, you're going to be just not knowing what the threat was.
So I think what you're hinting at there is this sort of forensic or high fidelity capturing of security data so that you can replay or dig into. It's like if somebody accuses you of being hacked, you have to be able to say, no, I wasn't. But you can't just say that. You have to come back with some proof or certainty that you weren't.
It's that, but it's also watching things as they happen so that you can do some form of human intelligence-based anomaly detection, right? You'd say, oh, this looks funny, and then you'll follow from there, and no system will be able to do that for you today.
So I guess the other part about this security planning or structure that we're putting in place is the angles. The ability to collect data at multiple points means multiple angles of view or positioning?
Yeah, I think the way to think about that is when you're observing the environment in which compromises are happening, if you're only looking at logs or you're only looking at some packets in an IDS, which is looking only for known bad things, you're bound to go into be missing something. The analogy here is when we look at, for instance, a military battlefield, you have a radar, there's an infrared camera, there is a drone overhead. You just take multiple angles on the same battlefield, hoping to capture the full picture.
Okay, so we've laid out three principles of security here from the way Riverbed comes forward with this. Eyes on everything, collecting at many points, full fidelity, so you've got forensic grade data capture and data visibility, and we've got this multiple angles. Let's break that down into a little bit of detail. So Vince, for eyes on everything, how does an organization collect at many points? That's a not insignificant challenge.
I think the important realization here is that building firewalls and placing IDS is necessary but not sufficient in terms of capturing what's happening. We had the example earlier of the dog barking, right? And we were alerting on known bad things. We're collecting those logs. What ends up happening is they're placed in a central location, but the very, very first thing, and this you see has happened in the movies as well, right? You know, once you get into the bank, what do? You shut off the camera, right? Hackers do the exact same thing. You compromise the server, you turn off logging. So when we're talking about eyes on everything, in the analogy is, let's capture the packets at the key interchanges. Let's capture flow data. I think flow data, net flow, IP fix data is hugely underutilized in the security space. It's so valuable and so few people capture it in full fidelity format.
So you're saying not just the perimeter, you've also got to get different points within the network to make sure you're seeing the full picture.
Well, yeah. So generally when we talk about packet style devices, because they, they're expensive. There's, lots of data flowing through. Capturing lots and lots of packets requires lots and lots of disks. So we see those strategically deployed often at the perimeter. But when we sort of like dive into what's happening inside the network, there's tons and tons of valuable information that might be captured at a broader level. For instance, a system that's compromised might be used to try to brute force a password in an RDP service elsewhere in a network. If you're only looking at your perimeter packets through an IDS or what have you, you're going to miss that data. Flow data is hugely valuable for that kind of stuff.
So just quickly, how do Riverbed products make me do this? So the challenge here is I sort of get the point, see everything, record everything, and have it from multiple angles for analysis. How do Riverbed products make me do this? SD-WAN, can I use my new devices to do that? Is it what's it look like?
Well, SD-WAN devices are routing devices, and they're very, very good at that. Often SD-WAN devices, like Riverbed's SD-WAN offering, comes with firewalling and IDS technology. Mm-hmm. But when we move sort of further towards what we see a lot of customers do is they'll use our app response appliances to capture packets, and those packets are stored in full fidelity format, meaning there is a forensic recall capability in the packets at strategic places in the network. And then for our flow data, we have the Net Profiler appliances, which can basically collect, the telephone record of anything that happened on your network at every switch, at every firewall, at every router in your network. Flow data can be produced. You get that really broad connection level visibility throughout your network with Net Profiler.
All right. So it's a spectrum of solutions or a spectrum of products. Can I build this up piece by piece? Like I don't have to go and buy them all at once and deploy them all out front. Because that's always a bit of a challenge. But it sounds to me like I could start with SD-WAN and then start building up the rest of these three principles of security.
Yeah, generally what we see people do is, well, you deploy your routing first, which is your SD-WAN solution. Then after that, you'd like to get some visibility in how well that is working. Then the very first security incident that happens and there isn't any data in the logs to find out what happened, people dive into, geez, can we take a look at what packets you've captured or is there any flows that you've captured? And so the security value of these appliances becomes evident. You start purchasing more capacity. You start laying that fabric of monitoring broader and broader to get the eyes on everything.
Any advice on how to instrument my network to make sure I'm looking at all the right things since there's so many moving parts here?
My background is in the NetFlow space, so I generally tell people, start by collecting NetFlow from every switch, router, and firewall anywhere in your network. And that helps you identify where the strategic interchanges are, where you can also do full fidelity packet reporting in addition to the border.
Okay, and that's going to be the NetProfiler tool.
Yeah.
And this notion of full fidelity, you mentioned packet capture. Is that what you mean by full fidelity?
Yeah, actually, in terms of packet capture, I think most people are familiar with the full fidelity forensic recording of packets. Not everybody does it, but a lot of tools are available that can help with it. When it comes to NetFlow data, I think it is more of a novel concept, not as frequently seen, and not as many security operators think about it. But if you are able to record NetFlow data in a full fidelity forensic recall format, what ends up happening is during that security incident, when you're trying to investigate what happened and who connected to whom, how long ago it started, that NetFlow data can really help you see the forest through the trees, if you will.
And that's where it's really important to get context and analysis, right? You can't just have a tool that says, here's the flow records, and here's a list of all the IP source and destination IPs. You actually have to apply some sort of software to that to say, oh, that's a known attack, or that's a likely attack, and things like that. This is where your alarms and alerts can't just be, I match this pattern, throw an alert. It has to be contextualized or valuable.
Yeah, and I think this is also an area where we are seeing a lot of value in behavioral analysis. And like the example here is your computer makes maybe 400 connections an hour. If all of a sudden it starts making 1,000 a minute, you know something is wrong. We might not exactly know what is wrong, but it's definitely a change in behavior that is interesting, which might be sort of the point where you dive into, geez, let me take a look at the packets and see what's in those connections. And you dig deeper and try to understand what has just happened.
So I guess what you really need then is a tool that makes it easy to go from alert, giving you some context and saying, yeah, and then you need to just click buttons and go in the GUI to say, go here. Oh, I can see the flow data is up very high. The flows look normal-ish. Then you click on the packet data and you're just all the way through as quickly as that possible.
Well, I think in security space, it's all about interoperability anyway, right? We, you know, sometimes you get your evidence from a log. Sometimes there's evidence in packet data. And by creating that context real rapidly, by looking at different angles, right, which is where we why we keep saying angles, you can quickly start building that context and an understanding of what has happened.
So if I'm capturing packets, I'm getting flows, I'm recording logs, and I've also got alerts and alarms coming at me, that tends to be too much for a human or a team of humans. So is there also a machine learning angle here, an artificial intelligence play?
Well, this is certainly something we've been leveraging, others have been leveraging. There is obviously the philosophy of, hey, you know what? Let's make the computer do what the computer is good at so the human can focus what the human is good at. So in this case, what that means, the computer is, for instance, able to take flow data, packet data, log data from hundreds of different collection locations and point out to the operator, these things seem to be happening together, or these things seem to be happening in sequence. And the operator can then do what the operator is good at and say, oh, I know what that means. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. You want to sort of start sifting through all that hay to find the needle and then let the human operator decide this is a good needle or a bad needle.
That's the needle in the needle stack. Yeah, it's a dangerous world out there.
You know, I think we could probably talk about security and visibility for a lot longer, but we've run out of time. So Marco and Vincent, where can folks go to find out more?
To get more information about our network performance management solutions, you can visit our website, www.riverbed.com, or read our blogs for latest updates at riverbed.com/blogs.
Well, thank you, Marco and Vincent, for joining us, and thank you to Riverbed for being a sponsor. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.